Hello and welcome to the Declined Estate Internet Radio Stream, the show in which we get together to discuss the ups and downs of life outside the Matrix. Declined Estate is proud to bring you one of the surprisingly few netcasts in which the hosts do not support acts of aggression against you. If at any point in the future you'd like to call in and weigh in on the conversation, please contact Skype user Declined Estate with a text message, and we'll do our best to get you on the air. If you are interested, we may keep you on. That's Declined Estate, spelled out one word, no punctuation. You can also find us at the web at our new official website, declinefm.com. And if there's a topic you want to hear discussed on the show, please submit to r/declinedestate@reddit.com. And unfortunately, it's currently down, but our live stream is radio.rudd-o, so radiorudo.com, radio.rudo.com/declinedestate.m3u. That's Mary 3 uniform. And today is a fairly momentous cast or podcast. I'll let the our manager introduce that. I'm Ronald McPaul. I'm joined by my handsome and at least one lovely co-casters, and I'm going to go around the horn and let them introduce themselves, but let's start with the man that brought us all together. He's kind of like the Michael Bluth of this family.
Hi, guys. This is Eternal, the head host and show manager for Declined Estate. It's great to be here, and I'm just really glad to be able to do this first cast for everybody. Declined Estate, is my kind of my inception for a radio show to give us all a place to discuss the ideas of liberty and how it applies to all sorts of topics outside of just politics. So I hope you all enjoy the show. Let's introduce all the hosts here. Yeah. First, we have...
You want to go down the line? I think we got Sistine, you're in here today, right?
Yeah. Otherwise known as Wrong Opinion on Reddit. I haunt various anarchist and liberty-themed areas on Reddit and occasionally post things. I'm known for getting banned from anarchism for telling a moderator no, and I've been involved in the liberty movement for getting around 2 years now. Only recently actually getting seriously involved, though, with things like this. So, and that's me.
And I am Toasty Time. And, I don't have too much of an introduction here, but I've been sort of locally active in the Liberty Movement for a couple years now. And, I'm delighted to have the chance to get my voice on the air.
And I'm Zom. I've only been on Reddit about a month. I came from 4chan's political section before that. On my first day at Reddit, while defending property rights, I made it to the top of Shit Reddit Says, and then just found R and Cap, and just started posting a little bit more.
And we're glad to have you.
Yeah, so generally speaking, you guys will suggest all sorts of content. You can go to reddit.com/r/declinedestate and post up articles that you want us to discuss on the show. Also, of course, you can call in on our Skype name at declinedestate. We will discuss anything you guys want, and anything goes, and we're always open to hearing new and interesting ideas.
So I think the first topic we were going to talk about today was, I think it was Nick Gillespie was on the Bill Maher show, and he sort of briefly mentioned voluntarism, which doesn't get too much airtime on the public airwaves, so to speak. And so he sort of got shouted down, and so I thought we could discuss what do you do when you're faced with emotional appeals, or what do you do when you're surrounded by people who are really opposed to you living peacefully? What are the argumentative techniques you can use, etc.?
Yeah, that's a tough situation. And again, sorry if you already mentioned, but Nick Gillespie is the editor-in-chief of Reason.com or Reason Magazine, which I guess they do a lot of interviews and shows up on their YouTube channel. And then, when do you know when that video occurred? I didn't actually. I'm one of the few that didn't see it. But was this is kind of like hot topic, right? Last like week or so.
Yeah, no, it got posted on the Decline to State subreddit just 2 or 3 days ago, I want to say. But I don't know when the air date was. Does anybody have that?
I think it was on Sunday on the Bill Maher show.
So, as Reddit users, we never see anything live on TV anyway, so I guess that's fine.
Unless it's Game of Thrones.
Unless it's Game of Thrones, yeah.
I don't even see that live on TV because screw HBO, I downloaded it off the Pirate Bay.
Oh, so do I, but...
Shh, guys.
Oh, but they know anyway, about it. So...
Yeah, moving on.
I was going to ask everybody here, you know, do you have any opinions on the whole Nick Gillespie event or... you know, just generally, what do you do when you have kind of, you know, a very liberal, you know, modern liberal person who's just shouting you down with emotional appeals? You know, how can we deal with this?
Well, I think the most important thing is, you know, when people are going to be closed to reason, you know, you kind of have to isolate them. Like, when you put a bunch of people in a room who are all just reinforcing each other's, you know, tribalism, you're not going to break through anybody. So going on that show at all, I don't know why Nick did it. I don't know why he even, you know, condones that is legitimizes that kind of a show, because it's terrible. I mean, just it's garbage.
It's yeah, it's frustrating it's not, to watch. It's not even to watch.
It's not even good political commentary. It's not. It's just, you know, biased opinions, a lot of childish behavior, and an audience that is completely one-sided and biased, and it's not discussion. It's just a forum for people to act like kids, basically.
I do see the appeal of trying to reach out to the audience who's so, you know, so in the grain, the statist, leftist, that they just really bat down anything. He did get off to a good start by mentioning property rights with fracking and about how it's not necessarily... how it's not necessarily as bad as the media might make it out to be. He did come off as a little bit of like a corporate apologist, but I do see kind of where he was trying to go. He really let Rachel Maddow get the best of him a couple times.
So you think, given the circumstances, you know, he fought okay, did okay, but it was just kind of ugly from the start, it sounds like. And I kind of, you know, I'm kind of with you, Eternal. I think, at least for myself, when possible, I try to avoid, you know, getting yourself in that situation where it's, I mean, even like you said, more than like than a one-on-one. With a one-on-one, you can have a reasonable conversation, but the tide turns at any point.
I think something important to consider here is that this fella didn't go on Bill Maher's show to convince Bill Maher to be an anarcho-capitalist or even anything close to that. He went on there to get the idea out there. You know, libertarian ideas out there. And even though he got shadowed down by Bill Maher's, you know, bicycle gang a couple times, the point is he still got some words and he still got some ideas out there. And there were people out there who were watching that TV show who will see the YouTube clips. And, you know, these people will be few, but they'll be out there and they'll actually think about it and say, you know, well, that idea is actually kind of interesting. Or, why were these people so afraid of what this man had to say that they felt the need to keep shouting him down? Good example, Ron Paul back in the 80s and early 90s when he was active for a time. He was shouted down in the media and in public all the time, but he still went out there because he knew that there were people who would still hear the idea and go, you know, hey, that's something interesting. You're not trying to convince your interlocutor. You're trying to convince the people who are watching.
Yeah, well, I mean, on one hand, I think he's not even trying to reach the audience of the Bill Maher show. I think he's actually trying to produce some stuff that gets people who hate Bill Maher more interested in his ideas, because they can be like, wow, Bill Maher is an ass. He runs this show, and it's populated by a bunch of children who just shout down dissenting opinions. And this poor guy, you know, his opinion that seems kind of interesting. Let's go. You know, why is it getting shouted down? They must really hate it, and I really hate him, so let's go check it out. So I think it's almost like a reverse you know, audience type thing. You go on a show that's run by a bunch of liberals to appeal to conservatives later.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's a fascinating thing about the distribution method now. We were talking about how we get all our content from Reddit because it's just, you know, it's better. It's more efficient, I guess. You have the first tier, the people that it's supposed to please, but then it makes the rounds and it's actually judged on the merit of the content of how good that show is or how much he trolled or how good the points got across. I see a penis in the chat, so I think that means somebody wants to chime in or be brave. So I guess if you guys want to move to a next topic,
actually, I have one more question first. I mean,
yeah.
I guess, as you said, this sort of maybe the Bill Maher syndrome corresponds to, you know, arguments on Reddit. I think that's something a lot of us are familiar with. That, you know, are you actually accomplishing anything by making these arguments on Reddit and largely getting shouted down, downvoted, etc.? I mean, does anyone think there are any circumstances where this is actually a good thing? I mean, do we want to keep completely isolated in that regard?
Well,
makes me uneasy to say that.
The thing about having these arguments is they're totally publicly visible. You're not just having a one-on-one argument with the person who you know you're not going to win against, right? What you want to do is get them to make the ridiculous argument for the bystander, so the bystander realizes, wow, that really doesn't make any sense, and the other person really has a good point. And then you want to get those people who are just viewing it randomly to maybe have a little bit of an effect and do that enough, you know, a couple hundred times, so those people actually join on your way of thinking and they come down maybe to your subreddit, maybe listen to our show, and turn on the other side.
And even if you're arguing with somebody who's an EPS troll, like poop is food, for example, you're still getting some practice to sharpen your debating teeth, because they will try to bring up little tricks and rhetoric to try to get you to say something contradictory to your own philosophy. It's a good way to, keep yourself sharp.
This is true. I think a big thing that, you know, we need to employ in general as voluntarists is to, you know, take, you know, the stuff that even the most radical leftists or the most, you know, radical conservatives, you know, and or, you know, religious people, whatever people, you know, believe in really strongly, take those positions and you just you get on board with it. You say, yeah, these are great ideas, and the stuff you do agree with, because there's got to be something we have in common with these people. We have something in common with everybody, and
that's a good attitude. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, take that, and then you slowly just veer the train off course. You just kind of derail it a little bit at a time towards our direction. And you slowly show, how, you know, if you follow, you know, that kind of voluntarist logic for a few things that we do agree on, you know, what if we apply it to these slightly different things and a little more different, and then stuff they totally disagree with. And then, you know, you kind of show them a little bit, you know, how hypocritical they are, but not in an underhanded way, not in it's kind of an attacking manner.
Yeah.
You can use their premises against them.
Yeah, exactly.
I think I get what you're saying, and I like it. I mean, it might sound superficially disingenuous to people to kind of, or like you're, you know, wolf in sheep's clothing or you're Trojan horsing in, but it works, and if you speak in on simple enough terms that everyone can relate, I mean, you go to the point where you're agreeing, and you're agreeing because I think we do, you know, we do relate. We're all people, and you can find something interesting about anybody you talk to. And at some point, you're going to see some dissonance or some frustration, or they're not going to buy it, and you're just going to pull back and say, all right, we'll save it for another day. We saw where that went. I mean, because you can't – you're not going to change all hearts and minds immediately, and you got to be reasonable. So anyways, I'm saying eternal, I'm with what you and Toasty Time are saying. It's good stuff. The Mr. Toasty Time, did that satisfy your intrigue on the topic?
Yeah, I think so. I'm certainly in agreement with you. And so I think next on our list, I think Zom had something regarding Bitcoin to talk about. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
On the Decline Estate page, we have a link from Nielsio, and it's Bitcoin from an Austrian perspective. I have to admit, although I did not read the link as thoroughly as I should have, I do have a little bit of opinion on the Bitcoin. Bitcoin, if you don't know, is a online digital cryptocurrency that was set up a few years ago by an unknown source, and the source code was distributed around the world, caught on within a few years. The way it works is there's an algorithm, which you can really look into it if you really want to. It's extremely secure and not really hackable. It works on a distributed basis, so it relies on other people to keep going. Essentially, Bitcoins are created every so often, and the amount of work that so-called work that's being done inside the system by your computer, the more work you're doing at the time the Bitcoin block is created, the more likely you are to get one. So it's kind of like a way of measuring, they call it mining. Sort of like,
yeah, that's a mining process you're talking about.
Basically, yeah. It's kind of like mining for gold. Whoever's working the hardest, though, at the time when the gold pops up, gets the gold. And the way it works, there will only ever be 21 million Bitcoins, and that's not going to be until a little bit down the road. Right now, I think it's about half of that. And so Bitcoin does have some properties that are, you know, useful as a currency. It is not replicable. It is, you know, finite by nature, sort of like gold, and it's very secure. But the thing about Bitcoin is that it has no inherent value, right? So it's not really money in the same sense that gold is money, because money has its own inherent value in and of itself, right? It has some kind of a use value.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like the Austrian perspective. No, of course, nothing really has inherent value. Like, values are subjective, but the difference is that you know, something like gold is physical. It has other uses. It can be used in jewelry or electronics or some other different things that we found over the years. I mean, historically, it was mostly used as a decorative item and jewelry. So, you know, from the Austrian perspective, is things have to be used for something first, and then people all agree on that, how useful that is. It's, you know, it's definitely something. It's definitely something where people have to, you know, find a use for the product first, and then it kind of shifts towards money. That's what,
because everyone already uses it.
Yeah,
it's so common and so prevalent.
Yeah, Bitcoin kind of breaks that idea because Bitcoins are completely manufactured. They're an artificial currency. They're not a naturally forming currency, and people, you know, have gotten on board with it. I mean, it's taken off and been quite successful so far. But the question is, why is it successful? Is this actually a stable currency? Or is the fact that there's nothing underlying, there's no use value, as you say, going to lead to it collapsing in on itself at some point? Is there some instability there, like fiat money?
And the crazy thing is that, I mean, we're all learning about it, and it's pretty simple. We all know on a day-to-day basis what money is. But then the other point, you know, with Bitcoin, you can learn almost infinitely, at least, because there's all this programming knowledge involved that, you know, you have to build confidence in it. People don't know, is this actually something that's safe? Is it actually finite? Can it be hacked? One of the most interesting things to me is it really anonymous, or can you actually be anonymous with using it? Go ahead, Tom.
Sorry, I lost my little train of thought. But yeah, it is anonymous in the sense that it's not easily traced back to you. And with enough collected data from the internet, like what the NSA might have, yeah, you could tie transactions to a person if you can really look down deep into, you know, the transaction from like your router and from your computer. But it is anonymous in the sense that it's extremely well distributed, but all the transactions are open. Like, they're all publicly, you know, published.
Yeah, one of the crazy things I saw is as people follow it more and more closely, there's like a list, right? It's published, like you said, and there's a website that has a list of like the biggest transactions so far, and it's up into the, I guess, what, several million dollars now.
Yeah, and the market cap is a couple million dollars.
Okay. Oh, for total for Bitcoin, or for how much is the biggest transaction? I was talking about the biggest transaction that's been made, the biggest exchange so far.
Oh, how much is the biggest exchange? I didn't know about that.
I think it was, I saw a post, and I'm sure this was, you know, maybe it's changing because it gets used more, but I think it was like a few million dollars.
What was it for?
I don't know, because it's all anonymous, right? We know that there's a name or there's a hashtag or whatever, or, you know, whatever there is. But
I'm actually going to Google this. Hold on.
It could have been a banking
research
transaction, which was most likely.
I mean, the implications there are huge, because it's like, how much taxes was that person avoiding, and did that cross state, you know, country lines? Because that would be freaking awesome.
It's all quite probable. Actually, yeah, the FBI came out against Bitcoin because of its potential use by terrorists.
Surprise.
Or yeah, it could be used by terrorists to fund things, or for kidnappers to anonymous transactions. Or yeah. A big thing is drugs, which I may or may
not.
Aren't
you
have
a terrorist
used
if you like use cash too? I'm pretty sure we're all terrorists.
We get on their lists.
Yeah.
So I actually have a couple of. This is blockchain.info. I don't really know what that site
is.
Enlighten
us.
But largest recent transactions. Yeah, let's see. Okay, so two came up. One was for 11,000 BTC. And there was another. And that was today, actually.
Wow. And
how much
is
June
27th? How much is that in like US dollars?
That's about $80,000.
Yeah, it's about 80,000. And there's another that was for 10,000 BTC. So
so those are the two biggest transactions yet?
No, that was today. That was June
27th.
So there's a serious amount of value that's moving through here. I'm actually shocked by that, how much this has taken off.
Yeah, leaps and bounds. I mean, personally, and I guess I don't really have any reason to be super secretive, or, you know, maybe just an interest of mine, but I was curious, because I don't have any Bitcoins yet, but I'm interested in it. And I know that, you know, it's anonymous, like you were saying, Zom, that when you have it, it's not, you know, tied to your name directly in any way. But there's always that transaction, and that's kind of like the line to the surface, right? Like you if you're on the surface of the ocean, you can, you know, and there's scuba divers under, you kind of know where they went in, right? Based on where their flag is and where they're heading up. And I'm curious if there's a way to actually be truly anonymous. I mean, and it might be overkill, and it might be, you know, splitting hairs, but
well, you have to associate the wallet, the Bitcoin wallet, that you know, string that represents, I guess, you know, the user's account, with the actual user, and you can't really do that with a person. You might be able to associate it with an IP address at best, but if you're like most consumers, you run your here's a bit of tech talk here, but you're running your IP address off of, you know, your computer into your router, and the router goes to your internet service provider's servers and gets, you know, there's a different IP there. There's something called network address translation, where like you have your 192.168 domain IP, and
today,
you know, that gets translated into something completely different. And the idea is you have that's a way to map multiple users to a single IP address further down the road that's actually owned by the internet service provider, so that the internet service provider might be able to figure out, you know, who you are, so that they might know, but anyone looking at it from the outside, just seeing the IP addresses, won't know anything.
So you're saying
you can completely get around that stuff by using VPNs. So if you're in a VPN, all that stuff is completely hidden, and there's no way they'll be able to ever find
it. Wow.
There are a few more ways to become a little more anonymous. Obviously, you can be as secure as you really want to be with this. You can just use it on your computer with the Bitcoin clients, or you can use an online wallet, which most people do, actually. Most people don't keep the wallet on their computer because then it's prone to hackers or to whatnot. Also, if you use it through Tor, which is a encrypted... it's kind of really hard to describe what Tor is, if anyone else wants to take that.
I have it. I'm not sure if I can explain it well. I like what it does, though. It's like a... I mean, for me, it runs as like an old version or an older version of Firefox. I'm sure it's updated now. But it's anonymous web browsing, essentially, where... and I'm sure it's not perfect. I'm told that there are flaws. But you can go on the web and be unseen. It's like, you know, Google Chrome's incognito mode, but and then some.
Okay, well, it's not... Obviously, it does have its own faults, but it was actually commissioned by the government for use by the CIA for anonymous browsing and contact.
Oh, that's a history I did not know.
Yeah, it's actually, its use was, it was spread out because the more people using it, the more secure it becomes. So people that are spies or whatnot that need to have completely anonymous, you know, transactions or anonymous... government hackers from other countries can access that information. So the more people that use Tor, the more secure it actually becomes because of how distributed it is.
Okay, and that's kind of what you want, right? Is that you want? By the way, you may have dropped out for a little bit.
Yeah, I think you dropped out for a bit there.
So we'll try to work on those connection issues, I guess. You might want to check your mic. I think it's resonating in the chat. But I guess when you have an anonymous service, right? I get what you're saying, that you want more and more people to be on there who aren't doing anything necessarily bad. Because if you have like a handful of people and they're anonymous, I mean, the quote unquote authorities are going to know that the person with the it's those five anonymous people. Those are the ones you want to go after, and it doesn't really serve their cause anymore.
Yeah, I remember hearing Adam Kokesh. I think it was him. I don't know if I should attribute this to him, but I heard somebody go out and tell his or her audience to just go and start doing completely mundane things with bitcoins or mundane things on Silk Road. Just to make it a little more cloudy for anybody who actually wants to pin something on somebody.
Get those number of transactions up.
That's correct.
You guys have encyclopedias up there. I like it.
Yeah. So I think getting back to the original topic that we were talking about with regards to Bitcoin, which is, of course, does it have enough of a real-world value that it doesn't fall into the category of funny money or fiat money?
Well, I think really the value of Bitcoin comes from its use, like not in the sense that it has like a real world use, but in simply a means of exchange anonymously between people. And the fact that in the current system that we're in, it definitely has its own gray or black market potential. And that's really where I think it gets most of its value from.
Yeah, I think I agree. Like, I think Bitcoin is useful and has value simply because, well, it's not dollars, it's not cash, it's not a state run currency, it's just something different, it's anonymous, and it's secure, and it's easy to make transactions internationally. So there are things that it can do that nothing else really can do without being tracked. Like, you can obviously exchange dollars for Australian dollars or yen or something like that. You can do international transactions digitally and securely, but it's still tracked. The anonymous
There's always someone
aspect
looking.
Is worth a lot.
Yeah, it's basically internet cash. Yeah. It doesn't cost anything to send to somebody. You don't have any record really of the transaction other than just the receipt of you sending the money, and you don't have to claim it on your taxes like a cash transaction.
So we seem to be in favor. And as far as like the long-term use, and Zom, I know you mentioned that there's going to be that 21 million max, I think is the number, which we're supposed to, it's projected to hit. We're not going to know. And with computer speeds increasing as they do, it's fairly predictable, but like maybe 10, 20 years down the road, which is, you might think is unfortunate because it might, they might get so scarce, it's not useful. But one thing I found out, which I thought was cool, is that apparently it's divisible up into like,
eight decimal points.
Yeah, 8 decimal points, right? So you can just
on
keep
the side,
dividing.
I was just looking, it listed 4, but maybe it's 8. I have no clue.
It's 8 or 10. It's pretty long.
Okay, and if we were wizards, we could all tell our listeners how good of an investment this would be.
So basically,
to buy them,
it's infinitely divisible. So you don't have to send somebody 1 Bitcoin or 2 Bitcoins. You can send them 1/1,000th of a Bitcoin if it really gets the value gets up there.
Which could be useful if a Bitcoin ends up being worth $1 million.
We can cross our fingers, right?
Yeah. Well, the only reason it'd be worth $1 million, I think it's going to be worth $1 million, but that's not because Bitcoins
going.
Are going to get much more valuable. As $1 are going to be worthless.
Yeah, I knew it. I love it.
Yeah, I saw that coming.
Yay, Zimbabwe.
I want $100 trillion bills.
I have a friend who has some. He ordered them.
I want to wallpaper my house with some of those.
They're pretty cool. He showed them to me. They have $100 trillion on it.
It looks so cool with all those zeros just scrolling out.
They're actually worth more now than they were worth then because people would view them as like kind of a collector's
it's
item.
Not
yes.
How much are they worth? Does anybody know?
You paid about like 10, 15 bucks, including shipping and everything, for a set of like several
worthless money.
If Ron Paul signs it, it's worth a couple thou.
Yes. That's true, huh? And then what's the upper limit, I guess, in terms of how much, you know, how much value? I mean, because it's silly numbers at that point. I guess just you can't, how many zeros you can actually fit on that bill? Because I know they're not going scientific notation.
Oh, they stopped using Zimbabwe dollars a long time ago.
But they kind of cap out at like what, like a trillion or something like that?
A hundred trillion.
People don't even know what the next number after a trillion is sometimes.
Quadrillion.
I think it's, but if people are like, what's a quadrillion?
I think it's a gorillion eternal.
You're funny.
Is that a good joke? I don't know.
Yeah, I think so.
We'll go with it for now. The new unit of currency.
Yeah. So, you know, overall, I think there is one problem with Bitcoin, which is that, you know, right now it's obviously better than everything else out there. What happens if we move back towards a free market and money? Will it survive? Is it really kind of stable in the really super long term? If dollars and all these fiat currencies start failing around the world,
it does have its use for internet transactions. So you don't have to have real world hand to hand contact. You know,
I can use dollars for internet transactions.
You really can't. You have to have some kind of an organization behind it that's holding those dollars.
Oh, yeah. What you're saying is that, you know, I would have to get my bank to make the transaction securely in digital currency from one point to another.
Exactly.
It's not like I can stick a dollar into my computer and, you know, then it disappears and gets transmitted over the internet.
I don't think I brought up, which the big thing about Bitcoins is there's no central agency. There's no organization that runs Bitcoin. It's a self-perpetuating, like, algorithm that people just use as a distributed network. So the more people that use it, the more secure it actually becomes and the faster the transactions are. Like, as it is now, transactions average me about half an hour to an hour. But sometimes I can get it up to about 3 or 4 minutes if I'm in like a more populated area.
Oh, so you're actively using it. Nice.
Oh, I actively use it, yes.
So I feel like if you want to break this down back to the Austrian principles, I guess the use value of Bitcoin is in itself inherent in what the money is. But it's also like, you know, it doesn't have to just be money. It's the anonymous transaction part, digital anonymous storage and transaction, that makes Bitcoin so strong. That's the real value that makes it worthwhile. Like, if you had Bitcoins, which were completely set in terms of dollars, in terms of their value, they would still be useful. Because, you know, even a Bitcoin that was another way to store dollars would still be a way to digitally store and transfer dollars on your own that value. Would be anonymous and secure. So there is some use value to Bitcoin outside of just being money that doesn't suck.
Well, it's really just really good exchange value is what you can say it is.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I was a big skeptic when Bitcoin came out. I was like, looks like funny money. And even if it's secure, you know, how do we make sure that, you know, the supply is constant? How do we know that?
Oh my God, we're all such skeptics. That's why we're here together. It's hilarious.
I thought the Feds might step in and gum things up a bit.
Apparently, they can't.
The thing about that is, there's no one to really take down. You know.
I just thought they might start picking at people individually that they realized had used Bitcoins at some point.
The problem is, like, doesn't Amazon accept Bitcoins now?
No, there are websites that will give you Amazon gift certificates instantly for Bitcoins at the current exchange rate, which is fantastic. It doesn't give you like any markup. It's at exact exchange rate.
Nice.
Which makes me think someone has a huge amount of Amazon money just sitting around.
I guess so.
Like Amazon, maybe.
Yeah, well, it could be very well run by them. We don't know it.
And about the skeptic side, I was really skeptical about it for a long time. I found out about it when it was under a dollar, actually. And then about a year later, I read more into it. And I'm like, wow, all these really smart people, like these, you know, computer science guys, are saying it's really fantastically secure, right? And then it got up to about, I think it was just over $2, right? $2.25. I bought right around $1,000 worth. And then about a month or two later, is when the Silk Road started becoming in the news, right? And then Congress had a meeting about the Silk Road, and then it spiked at $32.
Good man.
And on its way up, I sold it at $25.
Good man.
Wow.
Listen to Decline to State, Get Rich.
Oh, and then it crashed down to about $2 again. It crashed down to about $2 after it went up to $32. And then for a couple months, it stayed around $5, give or take 50 cents. And now I think it's up to about $6.50 or $7. It just jumped up in the past week or two to about over a dollar.
You see this... it's interesting you were talking about... Congress started talking about the Silk Road, started talking about Bitcoins. You know, it got in the mainstream. And then suddenly... a huge influx of demand came in and pushed the price sky high. And we should notice the same thing happened with gold a year ago or so.
A few years ago, yeah.
Yeah. What was it, back in 2000? It would have been 2011, I guess.
2008 or 2009 is when it had the big jump.
No, 2008, it lost a bunch. It gained a little bit, but it definitely got walloped in 2008.
There was a year it went up about $400, right?
Well, when it got up to
2011.
It was 2010 or 2011. I could look it up really quickly.
Aniran says it was 2009 it jumped up, which is what I thought.
Well, it jumped up like crazy in 2009, but it's at the peak where it hit almost 2000.
Oh, it was about only last year. 1850 or so, yeah, is what peak was. It wasn't quite
it got really high.
And we're leaving out the best part, guys. I mean, you brought up Aniran
says 1950.
You brought up the Silk Road, and I mean, the Silk Road is one of the first, most clearly visible, great implications for what you can do with Bitcoin. It's the place online where you could buy drugs. You use that Tor browser we were talking about previously, and you buy, the first thing people think of is illegal drugs. Anything you want, you can buy as it's like a normal exchange without, feeling the fear of the oppressors on your back. You can buy. I went on there. I finally got signed on, and I saw acid, ecstasy. Somebody sold it. I'm sure if it got sent to my house, I think it would appear as if I was getting a birthday card from my grandparents. And I didn't buy any. I still don't have bitcoins. I'm working on it, but I mean, it just warms your heart to see that.
Yeah, and it's not like we're condoning using all sorts of illegal drugs.
I am. No, I agree. I'm just kidding.
No. I obviously some stuff's really bad for you. Some stuff, is illegal for absolutely no reason.
I condone making up your own mind.
Yeah, but it's your choice, and I'm not going to tell you how you live your life, And yeah. Certainly, if you're going to get involved with it, I mean, it looks like Silk Road seems like a good way to go. Though I would certainly do your research. I mean, I have no experience with it. I don't have a reason to have experience with it. So. Yeah, I'm not the authority on Silk Road. Getting back to what I was saying earlier about when gold was spiking, I guess it got up to about 1950, and I guess it was last year. You could tell when it was really in the news, when we had debt in the news, when we had the debt ceiling in the news, when the mainstream media was going crazy about how everything's going to go to hell because of the debt ceiling and deficits were the big talk at the time, and we had everybody talking about it in the mainstream media. That's when all the money flooded into gold. And there seems to be this effect, whatever the mainstream media is talking about gets in this bubble state. And, it becomes impossible. All of the speculative money, all the dumb investors that just go by mainstream opinion flood in. And then everyone else sees that too. And they're like, oh man, it's a bubble. We can ride this guy to the top and then sell big. And of course, nobody knows when it's going to break.
People think it's the shit hits the fan moment is about to come. That's why.
And to an extent, there is some reasonable thinking behind, well, there's a debt ceiling thing going on. Maybe if we don't, raise the debt ceiling, then that'll be really bad for the dollar or something like this. I don't understand their reasoning. For me, I would think that raising the debt ceiling is the reason to buy gold, because that means we're printing more money. But other people think, it'll be a short term, really bad for the dollar. Maybe we can make a lot of money on gold and then go back. I don't really understand people's reasoning. I think most of mainstream investors are just stupid, and they don't understand how currencies work. They don't understand how money works.
Well, I think part of that, I really know very, very little about business and economics and the like, but I think the reason they didn't want to hit the debt ceiling is because they thought it would be disastrous for the value of their bonds. And so a ton of mainstream investors don't want that to happen because, oh, bonds are the safe haven. And so they, in the short term, I guess they thought raising the debt ceiling would prevent that or something. I mean, I don't know. I don't know too much.
Yeah, certainly the point I'm trying to make is, you know, when you see things in the mainstream media, when you see them in the news, I think that's a signal that they're overpriced, they're overvalued. You saw with like Facebook too, the Facebook IPO. When it came out, like, I don't know who the hell was buying it at the price it was at, because it was ridiculous. It was way, way overvalued. I think the PDE was like 50 to 1 or something at least.
It was outrageous.
Wait, you're saying it was up 1,000 P to E?
Wait, what are you talking about?
That's the price to earnings ratio, researchers are saying.
Okay.
Who was that?
PDE was 1,000.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what happens when these mainstream media people get involved and they're like, oh, well, okay, so this big, you know, very popular tool is going public or something. You know, oh, get in on this historic event, and they just play up the whole history value. LinkedIn is another example, and it's like, oh, this. I think Pandora was another example, and
Facebook
is a great example. Yeah, Facebook is and people want to get involved in history.
Oh, Instagram sold for $1 billion when it had no income.
Yeah,
it's insane.
Like, who's buying these things? It has got to be the biggest scam. And of course, you know, these are total scams, and the people that are selling the shares, like the companies, they're walking away billionaires or something. They're walking away rich.
Yeah.
I mean, so to the point where the U.S. government won't let these guys leave, you know, like one of the owners of Facebook.
Like, with housing, people are of this mindset since the housing bubble that when you buy something, well, it's just going to go up in value. Things just magically go up in value. And that's how people think. Oh, if they get in on this now, it's going to increase in value. I mean, there's, like, no one even thinks about, oh, is, like, you know, what the profit potential is. It's just...
My parents always told me that. They said, with land, they're not making any more of it, which implies it's always going to go up.
Well, think about it this way. You have a system where inflation continuously increases the amount of money supply, and people might not.
Whoa, we had one of our guest hosts show up. As Linnea.
Sorry.
As Linnea, go ahead. Your sound quality is a little bit off.
Like a ninja.
We will have to interrupt you because your sound quality is not amazing, but.
Okay. Yeah.
That's hilarious. Just come out of nowhere there. Yeah.
Yeah, I was surprised.
Sorry, guys.
No problem.
Yeah, yeah. Are you on a phone or something? Or
are you calling from the International Space Station?
Oh, I wish. That would be awesome. No, I'm just on my laptop. Sorry if the quality's sucky. My phone had a worse quality, so.
All right. Yeah. In any case, what were we even talking about before that? Just got blindsided.
Magical investment value.
No problem.
Yeah, right, investment value. Yeah, so what was I saying before? When people talk about all these crazy IPOs, you know, this idea that if you just get in on these hot things, you can make a lot of money, it's all a pump and dump scheme. It's a scam, and, you know, it's criminal almost. It really feels like fraud to me in a lot of these cases. Like, I don't understand how anybody could get in on this and legitimately think, you know, it's good. Part of the thing is, I think that a lot of I would like to see the breakdown of where the money is coming from for these IPOs, because maybe a lot of it comes from mutual funds and, you know, people spending other people's money. They don't really give a damn if they lose.
A lot of the Facebook money actually did come from mutual funds. Some people I know, their mutual fund apparently invested $50,000 of their money in Facebook. And then when it lost, 30% of its value, they were very angry. Very, very, very angry.
I'd sue them for negligence. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Well, you give them the right to do whatever you want with their money, you know?
Yeah, well, that's the other thing. Like, mutual funds on their own are scams. I mean, it's a joke. Mutual funds do not perform any better than a monkey hitting random buttons. You just close your eyes and pick random investments, and a mutual fund does not do.
Oh, better. No. But the 6%, they have to take off the top, right? You have to give those bankers their share. Come on.
Yeah.
Aren't you friendly? Come on. Yeah, those bankers get their cut, whether it profits or it loses. It doesn't matter.
Sure there are funds out there that aren't just blowing $50,000, you know, of your money on a Facebook IPO. But I don't have any experience in this, so maybe I'll just take your word for it.
These days, with inflation being what it is, like, even doing marginally better than even, like, you know, 2 or 3% is not going to cut it. You know, inflation, just the reported inflation is like, what, 3-some percent or around there.
Actual inflation is estimated to be about 8 to 12%.
Yeah, I heard this was back a couple years ago. I haven't really looked at the statistics computed with the old CPI, but the CPI was something like 9% or so for the past 3 years, and this was back in like 2010. So I don't even know what it is now, whether it's on up or down. But you can, anybody who goes and shops for their own groceries knows there's a lot of inflation. Prices are going up. It's, you know, it's just the way it is.
Oh, anyone who grocery shops has definitely noticed, you know?
Yeah.
I'm paying $120 a week to feed one person on a simple diet.
I think you might be eating a little bit of some luxury food there.
But what does that consist of, Sistine? What is that simple diet?
Meat and veggies. That's it. I don't get shit food or anything.
Sounds like a paleo diet.
Steak all week?
What? Yeah. I do eat paleo. I try to make it as cheap as I can. I only buy stuff that's on sale that fits inside paleo.
Wait, for those who don't know, could you explain paleo?
Well, the paleo diet is basically a diet designed to coincide with the sorts of foods that humans evolved to eat, the same foods that we've been eating for thousands and thousands of years. The simplest way to say it is nothing that's been processed. So grains and bread go right out the window, and obviously your Coca-Cola goes right out the window as well. Humans evolved eating meat. A large amount of vegetables, some fruits, and nuts, and that's pretty much it. That's all you need to survive.
Yeah. There's paleo, and I know there's also prime. I've looked into this. I'm starting to kind of wean myself towards that direction. But my thing is, you know, I love cheese. I really love dairy, and I know, I've read that like for paleo, some people can do dairy, like it's okay. Other people, like, they don't process it very well, and it definitely makes, you know, you continue to get the sugars out of it, and you don't move to that fat based digestion. I know there's also the primal stuff though, which I think is a little more lenient, and that's more about removing the processed foods as opposed to paleo, which is actually removing much more specific foods. And it seems
right.
The biggest thing about paleo, I think, is the removal of grain, isn't it?
That's the primary thing. Human beings do not actually digest grain all that well, and during the digestion process, you're not going to be able to squeeze the exact names of the toxins out of me, but certain toxins are, in fact, created that cause inflammation and a few other stresses on your body over a long period of time. And it causes problems or exacerbates problems like arthritis, heart disease, diabetes, all those kinds of things.
And it's all, you're going to have all those if currency continues to inflate. If you can't,
right.
your $150.
Well, that's because I actually buy meat.
We're making a divergence there.
I was going to say, if I don't mind, you don't mind me interrupting for a bit.
Oh, no, go ahead.
I think, the reason why it's kind of expensive to run, you know, a little more expensive on these paleo diet, you know, where you're eating healthy and you're eating stuff, you know, that you're probably supposed to be eating, like meat and vegetables, you know, fresh produce, not a lot of processed stuff, is because, well, we subsidize the fuck out of corn. We subsidize corn, and we tariff the hell out of, you know, actual cane sugar, which is still not great for you, but it's all corn, it's corn syrup and everything, everything's processed, subsidized to this guy, and then we wonder why, you know, people eat like crap. Well, I mean, you're paying people to eat like crap. That's what you do. So, you know, we're basically making our country, you know, dependent on corn, high fructose corn syrup, when we could be eating healthily for cheaper.
This is one of those.
It doesn't make any sense.
It's one of those things that I can't stand that I hear coming out of government all the time. It's they subsidize these things and they wonder, why do people eat all these things that we don't want them to eat? I'm like, well, you know, you subsidize things and then it increases. That's like the most basic of economic understanding, right? You subsidize something and then you get more of it.
And then New York goes and bans large soft drinks, right?
Yeah. Oh, God.
I mean, that's the old Harry Brown line. You know, government's good at one thing, and it breaks your leg and then hands you a crutch.
Right.
It says, look, we taught you how to walk. Without us, you couldn't walk.
Hey, since we're kind of segueing there already, we're talking about, you know, where like the system is pushing us and where we find ourselves. I know we're kind of diverging from Bitcoin and over to markets and inflating stuff artificially. But I guess if it pleases a crowd, I was interested in you guys were talking about when it was that you first kind of saw the state for what it was. And everyone's here talking about, you know, we're subsidizing one thing to only to tax a little bit later, and you're pushing and pulling, and it it seems like as a group we're pretty well able to follow the direction that it's pushing us, and can see the inconsistencies and see the silliness. But when did this stuff first start becoming obvious to you? I can say for me. Oh, go ahead if you want to.
I was gonna say go first, Ron.
Okay. I guess for me it was kind of a slow build. I knew that I mean I just couldn't take things for what it was. I always grew up in the most liberal areas. I was, you know, the People's Republic of Santa Monica is where I was, the place I was raised. It's actually referred to that way. But I had a very conservative family. So liberal areas, conservative family. So I never really bought, you know, anything either way, hook, line, and sinker. And you know, eventually, kind of from a, you know, from learning econ, more kind of a pragmatic approach, you kind of figured, okay, this part of what my dad's been bitching about with taxes as a conservative guy is true. You know, there are true sides from what the liberal side says, maybe less from an economic point of view. But it wasn't until, I guess, I was kind of applying my skeptical mind, taking classes, which were, you know, in college, which certainly had a point of view, certainly had a slant, but I could still kind of put my own view together. So I'd say probably in college is where things started making sense, where, like, you know, it was obvious that things were just clashing and you know, we're only pushing one thing just to pull on it in another direction.
All right. And for me, I was raised like an atheist Democrat. My mom really didn't expose me to religion. So I was always really not for, like, arbitrary authority to begin with. I was always really, like, against rules that didn't make sense. I would always question everything to, like, get the understanding behind why that decision was made. And growing up, it always just seemed like the Democrats were evil to me, because I was, like, raised, you know, like a liberal and a Democrat. So did I say Democrats were evil? I mean, Republicans are evil.
Yeah, but I get what you're saying.
They're the same thing.
You're raised from one side, and the other side is bad.
Yeah, I was raised extremely partisan, you know? So the other side...
yourself.
Yeah, so the other side really seems like it was, you know, the worst thing in the world, so I never really got out of that paradigm until I was a little older. And in high school, I got a little more into politics. I started reading a little on economics, and the Chicago school honestly made a lot of sense to me. Because I didn't really think about it from the force point of view. And so I really supported Obama in 2008. After that, I graduated. I went off, took some college classes, took some economics classes and some comparative government. And then I really started thinking. I'm like, wow, a lot of this stuff really doesn't make any fucking sense, right? Like, they say one thing and then they do the opposite. Or, you know, in the comparative government, we learned a lot about Iran and the U.S. involvement in Iran. I always knew that, you know, U.S. overseas involvement, I was always against a lot of it, about, you know, the empire and stuff. But really, with what happened with Iran really kind of pushed me, I think, over the edge of supporting really government at all, because they totally, they botched it up. You know, they botched it and then claimed that it did nothing, right?
Yeah. So kind of after voting for Obama and seeing that process not unfold the way that you were kind of hoping, I mean, that's to kind of expose the state for what it was.
Yeah. When Obama really started showing his hand, when he really, he ran as an anti-war, you know, president. He was going to shut down Guantanamo. He was going to end the wars overseas. He was going to legalize weed or whatever, you know, like, he really never said that, but it was almost like it was really strongly implied that he was going to, you know, fight against the drug war. But then everything was 180 of what he said, right? So I just started looking more into it, and I'm like, wow, this guy is exactly like Bush, like 100%.
Yeah.
And then I started realizing that maybe I should look at the other side, right? I've been a Democrat my entire life. I should check out what the other side is really saying, because they can't all just be crazy, right? Half the country can't be so wrong. So I started listening to Fox News Radio. Just to get the other point of view, I didn't necessarily like what they were saying, but there was always something, like, something behind it, you know? Something behind it that wasn't crazy.
Yeah, I hear
Glenn,
you.
Like, Glenn Beck, I brushed him off. I listened to him every day, just to listen to how crazy he was. But Rush Limbaugh, I actually kind of liked Rush Limbaugh. I mean, sure, he was a nut job and a racist and all this, but he had some kind of theory behind that I really wanted to get more into. And one night I was at work delivering some pizzas, and Free Talk Live came on the radio, on the Fox News radio station, actually. And then I just kind of went from there, you know. Once you hear Free Talk Live, when you've already been questioning politics, you kind of takes a hold of you.
And that's kind of when it fell into place. I mean, you knew that something was amiss. You tried to look for what you saw, the quote-unquote other side, to broaden your view. And then, you know, you found LRN or some of these Liberty Radio networks.
And then I found that it's not just two sides, right? You can be against both sides.
Yeah.
And then I realized that makes a lot more sense to me.
That's epiphany that I think a lot of people don't get to. It's lovely when you can reach them. But, I mean, yeah, I definitely emphasize what you're saying there. You just feel like you're stuck in this limbo state and nothing makes sense. And it's so frustrating. And I was, you know, I was always there too.
Yeah, I was totally disillusioned with everything. And I'm like, wow, if it's all fucked up, what can I do, right? Like, what is the solution if both sides are terrible, right? And then I found, you know, the Free State Project, and I'm like, wow, there is something that you can
do. Before that, you're just like, I just want something to make sense.
And if anyone doesn't know what the Free State Project is, does anybody want to explain that? Or should you want me to?
Sure, I guess I'll do that, and then I'll segue into my own stuff. Yeah, I guess Free State Project, it was started, when was it started? Like 10 years ago? 15 years ago?
It was a paper written in, I think, 2001, and then they got involved in like 06, to the state level. Yeah.
But the idea is that, you know, in New Hampshire, the Liberty Movement wanted one place where they could build a community and you know, have a center of nonviolent civil disobedience, to kind of take control of the local governments there, and in general have a community that supports activism. So that people can be there for each other, you know, and you know, have a support structure versus the state. So they have things like bail to jail, and they run Pork Fest, I believe. They actually are the people that run Pork Fest. Is that correct?
Actually, I just thought I would read off what the Free State Project site says as their mission statement.
That's a good idea.
Let's do the research. Yeah,
the Free State Project is an agreement among 20,000 pro-liberty activists to move to New Hampshire, where they will exert the fullest practical effort towards the creation of a society in which the maximum role of government is the protection of life, liberty, and property. The success of the project would likely entail reductions in taxation and regulation, reforms at all levels of government, to expand the individual rights and free markets, and a restoration of constitutional federalism, demonstrating the benefits of liberty to the rest of the nation and the world.
But at the core, it's a voluntarist movement. Like, I think a lot of those people would be perfectly fine having absolutely no government whatsoever.
Yeah, and there's a good
spectrum. It did say the maximum rule of government. There was no minimum rule.
Yeah, exactly.
True that. So, true that.
You know, clearly they want to make it open to anybody who's just kind of sick and tired of the overbearing federal government and wants to have a way to kind of get some sovereignty back. And I think that certainly is a big draw. I mean, I don't know if you guys are Tom Woods fans.
I love Tom Woods. Oh,
I am.
Nullification.
I was still curious about, I mean, when you kind of saw the state for what it was, I mean, was that around the same time you found out about the Free State Project? Or
oh, no, I found out about the Free State Project long after. Tom Woods was actually kind of closer. That's why I'm talking about nullification. That's one of the things.
I think
things
he was
that,
talking to me, weren't you?
Well, oh, I mean, sorry.
No, yeah, I actually found out about the Free State Project before, but I never looked into it because it kind of seemed just crazy because I was like a Democrat, you know? I never really thought about the words liberty and freedom and what they actually mean, you know? I thought they were just Republican talking points for a long time.
Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, so I guess I'll give my story at this point. You already got a little snippet of it. For me, I grew up in a more conservative household, but yeah, moderate. Not one of the Bible Belt type conservative families. You know, I would consider myself fairly, moderately conservative even now in terms of my outlooks in general.
So not like the extreme hardline stereotypical Christian conservative with all the topics.
I haven't even set foot in a church. That was the last time I set foot in a church. Like,
yeah, my parents tried to kind of drag me in. I could tell they weren't fully into it either.
One of my cousins, I was there for one of their baptisms. I don't know why the hell I went. I think I was just dragged there. This was many years ago. This must have been like 10 years ago. I think that was the last time I was actually in a church.
I don't know what that means. Just to interrupt here, and because I somehow know better than Eternal, I think the last time he was in a church-like building might have been for my bar mitzvah. Uh-oh.
Nice. Cat's out of the bag now.
Oh boy. No, it was later than that, but not much. I mean, yeah.
I just thought that might be funny.
I haven't been to a church for the purposes of worship.
Wouldn't it be a synagogue?
In like 15 years at least, so, you know. And that was a decision by my parents. Like, they haven't been either. So, you know, I didn't really have a religious, you know, upbringing in general. But it was
conservative, you'd say.
It was conservative, yeah, and they're still conservative. But, you know, overall, you know, the big things that did it for me, I got into economics. Milton Friedman was a bit of inspiration back when I was trying to learn economics. And then I kind of moved towards the Austrian, you know, Toasty Time did a lot to push me in that direction, but I moved towards the Austrian view of things. I really got into the whole liberty movement through a mixture of Ron Paul and his campaign and him not being a crook, basically. I was like, wow, this guy is like an honest guy. He seems like a normal human being. He's not a politician.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
so that made me feel good about, you know, where the core of the movement sat. And then there was the Austrian economics on top of that through the Mises Institute. And you had guys like Jeff Tucker, of course, you know, Rothbard was, you know, dead by then, but, you know, his stuff, and Joseph Salerno, and all the guys over at Walter Block, the guys over at Mises Institute, and they did really good stuff.
So there were, like, certainly individuals you followed who kind of, followed their worldview and kind of explored, like, on a a la carte basis.
Well, it just made sense to me. Like, the whole Austrian the viewpoint on economics made a lot of sense, and then it was vindicated big time with the crisis in 2008. And going back and looking at the predictions of people who followed the Austrian school, like, I mean, obviously not just the people at Mises Institute, but you have Ron Paul as well, who was talking about this stuff as early as like 2001. Really, I mean, earlier than that, he was talking about the fundamentals way before that, back in the 70s.
Yeah, and it's nice to have things you can actually
Peter Schiff
fact-check.
Was out talking about that stuff. I really got into him a couple years back, and I still listen to him a lot. So basically, a lot of these big core personalities brought me into the liberty movement, but what pushed me over the edge to be more of a voluntarist.
Yeah, or what made you like see the state for what it was, this system of force and pushing.
A lot of it was Molyneux, Stefan Molyneux, who runs Free Domain Radio, the largest philosophy radio, the largest philosophy community on the internet in general.
Yeah, I actually didn't even know who Molyneux was until I was way past the point, you know? Like, I was already signed up for the Free State Project. I'd already changed my entire view to voluntarism pretty much to a T. I was watching Adam vs. the Man, and then someone sent me a link about the Against Me argument, and that really hooked me.
Yeah, the philosophical viewpoint, and I mean, I'm with you too. I kind of joined this movement of people that were voluntarists, and then you had hit with these philosophical, ethical, and moral arguments that just kind of blew me away. I mean, I was there for, I guess, you know, because I, like Eternal, I came from an economic side of things. I'd studied, things were just kind of making sense and clicking for me, and I was like, oh, there's this whole other layer on top of things of just reasons why this is morally repugnant, and it makes a lot of sense.
Oh, yeah, like, when I found the non-aggression principle, like, I actually teared up. Like, I had never seen words on paper that fit my life so perfectly, right? Like, it's how I tried to live my life since I was a child, and I just never saw that codified in, like, a paragraph.
Yeah, it's so simple, too, isn't it? It's so trivial and simple, and you're like, what the heck? Why is this not having more exposure? Why do people not accept this simple idea?
Yeah,
it just, like, makes sense.
Molyneux says it all the time, right? It's like what we're taught as children. Like, stealing is bad, pushing is bad. And, like, when I started growing up, like, other people stopped doing those things. They started acting differently in, like, middle school and high school. And I always was like, why did this become not good? Like, when did this stuff become good all of a sudden, right? Like, why is this encouraged? Like, why is this violence so prevalent in society? And it was just me sitting there the whole time, like, basically, like, I was like a porcupine, right? I was, like, the non-aggression principle guy, even though I didn't know it.
And that's kind of the reason for the topic, because I mean, it sounds like it kind of fits, because all of us had this experience where all of a sudden it just hits you. And you're like, oh, this is just bad. It's corrupt, or there's something wrong here. And it kind of hits you. It hits you kind of all of a sudden. You said you were, you know, you had the experience of tearing up. I think I kind of got, you know, caught emotionally by some of these arguments too. I think, you know, to keep it going, I think Toasty Time, you had a, you know, similar story of your own.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how similar it was, but like Eternal, I mean, I grew up in a really conservative house, you know, and, you know, conservative to the extent that, you know, the other side was really very vilified. Still is, actually. You know, my parents' political beliefs haven't changed in the slightest.
And you guys are good friends, right? Since, like, as long as you can
remember. Yeah, yeah. Full disclosure, we have known each other since elementary school. Still live in the same area. So we've been friends since then. And I think we're mutually, you know, beneficial toward the end of liberty in general. You know, we had that philosophical journey, you know, pretty much at the same time.
We're like Sam and Frodo, taking the ring of Mordor. No,
yeah,
homo.
Sure. No,
And you're talking about conservative parents. Are your parents friends? Do they know each other? Are they?
No, only through us.
Okay.
Yeah.
But regardless, you know, I guess, I think I had, even starting in high school, I sort of had a couple of sort of pro-liberty influences. My brother has been, like, a longtime Libertarian Party member. I think he got back in, you know, he got involved in the days when Harry Brown was the big thing. And, you know, that was, and, you know, I like Harry Brown a lot and whatever, but, and then I think in high school I had a couple teachers who were pretty anti-authoritarian, even, like, an anarchist government teacher.
Okay.
You know?
Wow. We're talking about kind of walking alone in the dark and being confused and having influences from, you know, these two defined sides. And it sounded like you had stuff on your radar. You had, you know, a brother who made you aware. He maybe didn't teach you what the state was, but he made you aware that there is, you know, a third option. There are people that don't hold these two mainstream views.
Yeah, but, you know, even up until I got to college, I thought it was sort of laughable. I still sort of would parade around with a mantra of, like, you know, you gotta make your vote count. You gotta, you vote Republican, because otherwise it doesn't matter.
Don't throw your vote away.
Right. And, you know, I even did vote for Ron Paul in the 2008 primaries. You know, for what that's worth. I don't really know why. I think I got caught up just sort of in the bandwagon effect as far as that goes, even if it is the right choice.
He just wasn't reprehensible.
Yeah, I mean, I just didn't have anything against the guy.
Everyone else is so awful.
Exactly.
McCain, Giuliani.
Ron Paul. Even when I was a Democrat for the longest time, I always looked at Ron Paul and, like, wow, this guy makes at least a little bit of sense, right? Like, he's the only consistent person I've ever seen in politics.
Yeah, although in high school, I do have to say, I had no clue what consistency was. You know, I wasn't, It took until college for that to happen.
Consistency is the measure of how bad the mashed potatoes at the cafeteria were, you know.
Yeah, if you say so. And, you know, so once I got to college, one of the things that's really been maybe most influential on my life is I majored in math. And so I tried to treat literally everything around me like a proof. And so that sort of put me on this like eternal quest for consistency once I got into college, because I took some philosophy classes and I had, eternal, I'm a nerd, I know it. Okay. And so I had like a philosophy class with a prof who rightly said that, you know, no matter what philosophical beliefs you have to acknowledge that wrong philosophies were actually the most destructive things.
So you were on the lookout, you're on the prowl at that point.
Yeah, it was a mix of that and when I realized that there were tons of these ideologies around which were incredibly violent. And I knew that was sort of, it was incredibly wrong to be that violent. And so that sort of put me up in maybe a philosophical limbo where I didn't, you know, something was wrong, a lot of these things are wrong, but I don't know exactly what it is. And it was about that time that... I sort of decided, yeah, I ought to go read some Ayn Rand, and sort of, it was,
but
it was,
and it sounds like at
very,
that point,
yeah,
compared
go
with
ahead.
Your high school experience, that you were, I mean, at least, you might not have had the answers, but at least you were on a quest, like, and it sounds like from a high school point, you kind of felt like you were just, things, you know, not necessarily in the dark, you had some influences, but, you know, things didn't make sense, it wasn't cohesive yet, and
yeah, exactly.
When you got to college, you kind of had things put together as... Or you at least had a goal and a direction to take things. Like, I'm going to apply
logic. Yeah, absolutely.
Logic. Okay. That's right.
Actually, in high school, all of my friends were in AP classes, and they had them read Atlas Shrugged for one of the classes. And looking
back...
Wait,
your high school?
Yeah, Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead were in one of our AP classes for AP language, I think.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and looking back, if I had been in that class, I think it would have taken me 4 less years than it took me to be in the position I'm in now. You know what I mean? I think I probably would have already been in the Free State Project in New Hampshire if I had been in that AP class and I was exposed to Ayn Rand. Interestingly enough, I've never read an Ayn Rand book, which I think I'm pretty alone in that sentiment.
I haven't either. And I get asked it. If people get anywhere, you know, go down the rabbit hole with me, they're like, oh, you just like... Ron Paul, are you one of those Ayn Rand people? And I haven't read Ayn Rand. I know who she is, obviously, but...
I mean, I think you should. It was pretty influential on my life.
I like Atlas Shrugged.
Yeah, I love Atlas Shrugged for, like, just for the literature aspect of it.
Yeah,
I think it's a great book, and it was very entertaining. And so it was about that time, I feel like... Yeah. It was about that time, I think I felt like, after reading that, I realized that, you know... You know, my philosophy profs just, there were things that they just weren't telling me. And so at that point, I sort of went out on, you know, a search on my own for, you know, what's going on. I guess I stumbled across Mises.org. I read an excerpt from For a New Liberty from Rothbard. And it was probably just then I realized, wow, like I self-identified, I am a libertarian now.
It's
like,
weird to do, right? It's really
weird
to do that.
Changing your what you like self-label as is actually a really emotional period in your life, just at least for me. I mean, maybe a lot of people don't have that experience, but
I definitely
go through that
did
a little bit internally.
Because everyone I knew was, they grew up with me and they knew I was like a Democrat and they all kind of aligned the same way. So when all of a sudden I started talking different stuff, right? They're like, wait, you're not like a socialist anymore? You're not like... You know, all this stuff.
Bro, that's not cool.
Yeah, actually, in high school, interesting, I was in, if you guys know what FBLA is, Future Business Leaders of America, it's like an extracurricular, and we have these competitions, and one of our competitions was, that I did, I was when I was a senior, was it was a debate, and we were presented with a point of view that we had to take the pro side, and the pro side was we had to support... the government involvement in healthcare. Like, why is it a good idea, right? So I took this to its logical conclusion, and I talked about universal healthcare. Because at the end of the line, that's really as far as you can take the pro argument. It's really funny because the guy I took it with, the guy that's like a friend of mine for about 6 or 7 years now, who he's a political science major, a Keynesian economics guy, and he really hates me now. Yeah, he was totally with me. So when I kind of broke the news to him that I became an anti-statist, he's like, whoa, when did this happen? I thought you were a socialist, right? He's like, what happened? Like, where did you change? And then when I try to make the arguments to him, he just tells me to shut up and I'm stupid, I'm not educated. And he's like, because he has all these professors, right? And he's like, well, my professor says this and this, and just because you read all this shit on the internet doesn't make you have a PhD. And I'm like, whoa, just because the guys that give you your information have a PhD doesn't mean they know what they're talking about, you know?
Yeah, argument from authority. So he's right.
He's 100% statist. Like, he uses fallacies all
mechanism.
The time. Oh, it definitely is. Like, he doesn't want to hear the other side.
Well, it's a defense mechanism in the sense that he spent a lot of time and effort pleasing the people in power. He spent a lot of time and effort learning, you know, spending time in classes, spending all his money, you know, getting this education and all this material. He needs to, you know, it's a, you know, way to justify, like, all the time and energy he spent learning bullshit. Because, you know, if he admits that it's bullshit, then I'm like, fuck, I've wasted, you know, 10 years of my life or something learning nothing.
Oh, and it's actually, this guy's kind of, he kind of scares me sometimes, because when I ask him, like, an opinion on, like, a certain topic, he never actually gives me what he thinks. He always appeals to authority. He's like, well, this guy says this, or this paper says this, or these numbers are like this. I'm like, I don't care about those. I want to know what the fuck you think about it, right? And he's like, well, he's like, it's not important. It doesn't matter what I think. It matters what the numbers are. I'm like, no. The most important thing is your opinion on the matter, you know? Like, how you feel about those numbers.
A lot of people just don't have the self-confidence, you know, to make their own arguments. I mean, okay, yeah, personally, I blame the school systems for that, but I see it everywhere, and people just lack the confidence to form their own, you know, to manipulate the logic on their own, form their own opinions.
I think he just wants to be the in-the-system kind of, you know, politician, that he doesn't want to have anything on paper about his opinion, you know what I mean? Kind of like, I don't know if you've seen, like, Barack Obama. He never published a paper, right? He never really had anything down about how he actually thought about the world. That's because he doesn't really think anything. He just wants to sell out, right?
Yeah, I guess that's right.
Toasty
that's
time.
How I feel about my friend. He just wants to sell out.
Toasty You're friends time. With Barack Obama, man.
What's up?
Oh, I was just saying that you just mentioned that, you know, a lot of these people are scared of applying this logic, like, in their, you know, in their real life, or actually putting the, you know, applying these things. And you mentioned Atlas Shrugged, I think, was the Ayn Rand book you read that kind of was pivotal for you in a way of kind of seeing how things worked.
Well, yeah, I mean, not in regards to philosophy so much as maybe just...
And by philosophy,
you know,
here, you mean like logic. You didn't really... That wasn't as pivotal with the logic being applied, or...
Right, but what it did show me is that there are really other beliefs out there that are very fleshed out and maybe consistent. And so... You know, after that, even though I guess objectivism itself wasn't until later something that, you know, I identified with, you know, it still sort of gave me that kick, like, hey, you need to look for, you know, other people who have these ideas, you know, work out what it is that you believe. Don't be afraid of your professors telling you that you're wrong and giving you C's on your papers.
That's super
helpful. Don't worry about that. You got to form these beliefs for yourself. And I think it was that paired with the confidence that I think majoring in like pure math forced me to have.
You had confidence in your logical ability.
Exactly. It gave me confidence in my own logic. And yeah, it's all I have. So it was after that, maybe a year after that, I found, you know,
Mises.org, you said?
Mises.org, yeah.
And it kind of, I mean, I'm getting as a theme, like I know David mentioned, he was going more by names and you're mentioning community. I think for me, I was kind of caught in the net of fee.org, or Foundation for Economic Education, which isn't as big as Mises, but for some reason that's what I wound up at. But it sounds like those were important for grabbing people.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, what made me take the step towards, like, even going, you know, beyond minarchist to, you know, voluntarist, whatever you want to call it, you know, ANCAP. I mean, I have to cite Molyneux for that, because even though I had actually read, my first dabbling in ANCAP theory, I think was, I think it was Walter Block's, I think it was him, Chaos Theory.
That's Robert Murphy. Bob Murphy.
Oh, Bob Murphy. Yeah, okay, sorry about that. Yeah, Bob Murphy's chaos theory.
It's okay. We won't punish you.
Yeah,
you can get it. It should be free.
Yeah, it's
even
free
the audiobook.
On Mises.org. Yeah,
www.mises.org.
Put it on my Kindle back then. And, you know, I just read through that, and that sort of just addressed, you know, all the concerns I had, like national defense, and all the, well, in particular, national defense and courts. It covered both. And
doesn't reading stuff or being associated with a thing that has anarchy or anarcho attached to it, doesn't it feel so taboo or risque when you first start dabbling
in
it? Oh,
when I was a minarchist, I was like, look at those ANCAP people.
Right.
They're so silly. I don't know what they think, but they're wrong. You know, minarchism is right.
Because we're taught from such a young age that anarchy equals chaos.
Yeah.
And, cool. Sorry, if we were talking about the first things that we read in terms of economic theory, when I was in college and I was taking my econ class, at the same time I was reading both Abominomics, which was kind of funny, as well as...
Just a good name.
Oh, first of all, it's fantastic because it entirely lays out Obama's economic plan, which he actually introduces exactly what's in the book, like 100%, and then people are surprised when he does it, which is the funniest thing. But at the same time, I was also reading The World is Flat, which is a really good book that talks about globalization. And then my economics teacher actually told me to read For a New Liberty, which, looking back, was really weird because she was a Keynesian. And she told me to read it just to get the other point of view because I think she saw kind of like how I thought. She saw how I thought and thought I might like it.
Intellectual honesty? Wow.
I know, right? It's fantastic. And then I read that and I was like, I was hooked on Rothbard.
Mm-hmm.
All right, go.
Right, and I guess to just finish up my, I was about to say little story, but it's anything but little. You know, I guess after that I had come across Molyneux, and really, after I sort of had all these beliefs, I knew the ANCAP societal structure, so to speak, would work. And it just sort of took somebody telling me forcefully, like, that, you know, it's possible, it's right, and indeed it's moral, that really just got me to label myself that way. And I think, you know, even the same effect is true. And I now consider myself an atheist, right? And it certainly wasn't always that way. I mentioned a bar mitzvah before, right? And it just sort of took, you know, some really people telling me forcefully, like, you know, your morality doesn't come from, you know, your religion. Neither does your history. You're just a person. Like, why are you labeling yourself as religious? Like, and after that, I was kind of like, yeah, you're right. I guess I'm an atheist.
Yeah. So I wanted to kind of move along the discussion to something a little different, change gears here.
Yeah. Thanks everybody for sharing your story of your realization of what the state was and seeing the Matrix.
Yeah. This has been my favorite topic so far. I love hearing stories.
It's been good.
Yeah, story time's great. I should have gotten like some s'mores or something. You
know, fire. S'mores.
I love s'mores. Yeah. I can't wait to hear. Like, so with our show for the listeners, what we're doing is we have much more than just the handful of people that you're listening to right now involved with the show. We have up to, you know, I guess close to 20 people involved with the show in some manner. So we'll probably have. At least another, you know, 4 to 6, maybe more than that, hosts rotating in and out with the show from episode to episode. Obviously, you know, I'll probably be around for most of them, but you know, I can't wait to hear the opinions and the stories from other people.
Yeah, it's a great rabbit hole to go down where you can kind of investigate the path and. Especially with people with kind of international, we have Australians, we have Ecuadorian of note.
Well, it's a good way to realize how to approach it to other people.
Well, everyone's different. I mean, every single person has a different story. It's the wonderful thing about it is, you know, how you can take people from all sorts of different upbringings and they still come to the same conclusion. Yeah, and that's, you know, that's an important quality for our movement in general, which is that we can reach an enormously broad array of people if we just know how to approach them. So there's no person that is out of reach.
Personally, I just get a kick out of knowing that, you know, I'm so egocentric, I feel like everybody must have grown up conservative and then found libertarianism and made that, like, progression there. But that's just not the case, and I love hearing the stories about it.
Yeah, I think I'm the only person here that came from the progressive Democrat side. I was totally pro-regulation and pro-price controls and all that. Like, I was... I read the Communist Manifesto in high school, and I was, like, a total socialist.
Yeah, and hey, we even have, I know Super Nintendo, who is going to host some other night, I guess. I mean, he came from left anarchism, so to speak. I mean, anarchism, you know, that whole side of things, I think. Socialism. Is that right?
Yeah, I think he's talking about how he was a communist. Right.
Yeah,
so, I mean, people are coming from every side.
It's weird how he said Molyneux converted him to anarcho-communism, which I've never thought before.
Yeah, I always think of Molyneux as being more suited for maybe, like, former conservatives, just because he's actually, in his own personal life, he's kind of socially conservative. Like, you know, he cares deeply about the family and parenting and things like that.
Minus
and
so the religion stuff.
Well, who's against family?
There are people out there who are.
Feminists. Yeah, feminists.
Feminists, statists, anyone who's for, you know, the welfare state.
So the moral of the story is there's plenty of good material, and if we if people request it, make sure to go to r/declinedestate on reddit.com. Let us know if you want to hear more of this topic or something else. We're open to feedback.
Or tell us your own stories. We love hearing it.
Oh, that would be great.
You can call on the Skype at declinedestate.
That is when we have it.
Yeah. So you guys are aware, obviously, you know, this show is not live. This show is recorded because our hosting servers, they died. The drive failed. So we can't pump the stream up from our chat, which is the most unfortunate. Of course, in the first show, we'll have like the most abysmal technical failure.
Yeah, we were working pretty well up until today.
Yeah, but for future shows, you can always call into Skype at Declined Estate, and we're welcome to hear any stories you have, anything you want to talk about, any feedback you want to give, any criticisms you have. Especially, you know, bring up criticisms, you know, of what we're talking about. Tell us we're wrong, because we do enjoy arguing. It's a lot of fun.
Or maybe we're wrong. You know, prove us wrong. Just go for it. I just want calls.
Yeah, no, that'd be great if I found out I was wrong about things.
Good stuff. Yeah, we're always open to being wrong. We've been wrong before, and we will be wrong again. That's a promise. Eternal, you wanted to? Did you want to move to another topic? I know we're getting about an hour and a half.
Yeah. There's another article I wanted to talk about. This is an article from NPR. It's titled "Video Game Company Hires Economist to Study Virtual Worlds." And it's about the company that many Redditors and many people are familiar with now, called Valve. They produce a lot of big name games. They're I guess most well known nowadays for the Half-Life series, Team Fortress 2, Portal and Portal 2,
Dota 2 now.
Oh yeah, Dota 2. Yeah, they have that out.
And Left 4 Dead.
Left 4 Dead. That was Valve. I think do they have some other titles?
Well, sure. Counter-Strike. I mean, technically that's Half-Life, but...
Yeah, they have some hairs. They have some smaller titles, but those are definitely the big box games they have.
Yeah. Well, in any case, the article... I can read some excerpts from it.
And is this on r/declinedestate?
Yeah. This is posted on r/declinedestate.
Great.
It's an NPR article. And the idea is that, you know... Valve hired an economist to take a look at the virtual economy that came about from the ability of players to acquire certain goods in Team Fortress 2, like upgrades and whatnot, and cosmetic accessories, and then they could trade them to each other. They could buy them for real money, they could trade them to each other, and they could, I guess, find them in-game as well.
Yeah, the way items work is about every 50 minutes or so, which is the average, you get essentially a random block of items. And Those can include weapons, garbage items, these crates that hold items that you need keys to open, as well as hats.
Yeah, and the idea was, you know, they hired this economist to take a look at, you know, how exactly the currencies in the game come about, because it's a barter economy. You just trade item for item. It's not like there's a pre-designed currency. There's just items, and you can trade them for each other. But currencies have emerged in this virtual economy, where some things like keys and I guess some certain hats,
well,
rare hats.
Actually, what the economist originally thought is that keys would emerge as the currency, because one of the items that you can acquire randomly are they're called Manco crates, and you need to purchase a key for $250 from the store. The only way to get a key is to buy one, and so he thought those would emerge as currency, but he realized that's not so much the case.
Yeah, and instead, what ended up being currency was a mix of things. I mean, keys do play somewhat of a currency role, but there's also
it's definitely metal,
which is used to craft items. So just the basic building blocks for a lot of different items, that seems to be function as a currency.
What was that latter one you just mentioned?
Metal.
Scrap metal.
Like,
yeah.
Scrap metal, yeah.
And is this in the game? Sorry, is this all Valve games, or just like something just like Team Fortress 2?
Team Fortress 2.
Okay.
It's just Team Fortress 2. It's just one of their games.
I have played that one. I haven't played all of them, but I am aware of the importance of hats in that game. They're very, very cute.
Yeah. He realized that hats actually arose as the biggest amount of value, right? Scrap metal has value, but it's very small, because you can destroy items to create scrap metal. So he realized that hats, which are just purely visual in nature, only a very small percentage actually have an increase in like gameplay. A lot of them are just visual. Some give you some stat boosts, but most of them just kind of look cool.
Yeah, and the idea is there are a lot of seasonal or promotional release hats that come out, and there's a limited supply. There's you know, maybe 500 of these get released, and that's it. So it's a static supply. And you know, what's happened is over time, as you know, more keys, more metal and stuff, you know, are discovered by players and then bought by players, the values of those relative to hats, you know, changes just like real currencies do, of course. Hats become more and more value. There's deflation in terms of hats. And
so as we get our econ nerd on, you're kind of speaking to the spontaneous order that's arisen in the video game community, or specifically Valve, where they thought it was going to be keys were going to be the main form of currency, but it's become, you know, metal and hats or what did it end
metal
up?
Hats and keys. What happened is there's different currencies for different valuations of trades. Like really expensive trades usually are in hats. Really cheap trades are usually in metal, and like somewhere in the middle are keys. And then
that's there's
and what happens is it kind of links it all to real money value as well, because obviously you can buy keys for real money. So it's interesting. A full economy has developed, and it's just like the Austrians say, you know, things which are used, things which are scarce, are and things that have real value to players,
they become money.
They become money naturally. That's how money is formed.
Sort of like gold.
Completely baffled this economist that they hired. He was like, oh man, you know, what determines when one thing or another serves as money? I have not managed just to shed light on this. I'm like, well, it's a good thing you don't have
too
to.
Too bad
because
he's like 100 years late.
And Mises did this, you know. Yeah.
And actually, the hats actually draw an interesting correlation to gold, right? Because gold, they liked it because it was pretty, right? And then eventually it became money because of how people like treated it. And then hats became the exact same thing. They're just pretty, but they're also finite. So because people like looking pretty, they hold that to a higher value than other things. So they use that as the money to acquire other items that actually increase your gameplay.
It doesn't have to actually be useful. It just has to be something that is valued. Like, there's no use for hats. It just looks pretty. But that's a value. I mean, people value, you know, having the hats. It's a sign of status.
Status symbol, definitely.
It's a status symbol. And apparently, like, when people wear these really, really Definitely. Wear hats in game. It's like the most elitist snobbish thing you can do.
It 100%
people get all pissy
is.
About it.
I actually had a rare pair of glasses, right? I just found them in the game randomly, and I had no idea what they were. And every single person in the server went, "Holy crap, nice drop, can I get that off you? Please, 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 please." And I'm like, I just started playing for the first time in a couple months, and I'm like, I didn't know the value of it, so I traded it away really cheap, right? So I look it up later, and it was worth like 20 times what I traded it for.
So yeah. not such a good trade as your previous Bitcoin transaction.
No, definitely not. I should have realized when everyone wanted it that it was valuable, but I really just didn't care, you know?
Supply and demand, real time. You saw it.
Yeah, I think it's funny. As the last line in the article is a quote from The Economist, where he says the dividing line between economic analysis and game design is suddenly blurred, and effectively they're designing markets even if they don't know they're doing it. And, you know, since learning a little bit about economics, I think it's been funny to watch what's happened in video games I've played. Because, you know, video game economies certainly aren't limited to Team Fortress 2. I mean, way back in the day, my first experience with it might have been in Diablo 2, where de facto currencies emerged. Like, there was a valuable ring that like 80% of classes needed called an SOJ, and people used that as currency. I mean, that was you knew you could trade for that SOJ because you could unload it on anybody else in the game.
You could sell it on eBay, which for a large amount.
Oh yeah.
If you were
absolutely.
On a ranked server, you could sell those for over $100 at one point.
Yeah, and now in the newer patches, like runes serve the same purpose. But I mean, in the end, the reason the SOJ was so valuable is because it was the best in slot item for, you know, like 80% of the playable classes.
But it's interesting to see. Every time they would reset those servers, everyone would start over from scratch. They'd have to start new characters and everything. No items were around. It was, you know, just everyone starting from scratch. You had to find everything. And you could see, as people progressed, what items, some items had a huge amount of value at a certain point in the game, and then they would devalue crazily over time. And, you know, it would be just like a real economy, where as people grow their item pool, or capital, as I would call it, like the way to get more items in that game is to have items, so you get good items to get even better items by killing even stronger monsters and bosses and whatnot. And as people grew their stash, you have deflation. I mean, stuff would become, or rather inflation, I should say. You had inflation in that things become worth less and less over time. So, you know, something that was really valuable one day, a week later, maybe there's like a bunch of people that have found it and, you know, it's not worth as much.
Yeah. And actually, there's an interesting line to be drawn here between how Diablo worked with updates and sort of like how the state runs the economy. If you look at each instance of the ladder, which is like the ranked kind of servers, each time those get reset, you can consider that almost like a new economy, right? And so there were actually some updates in D2 that caused a lot of ruckus because it totally changed the way items were distributed. And it totally collapsed the economy just because they changed like a few item drops, right? So this is kind of, I kind of look at the same way when the state changes how they do business, right? They wonder why everyone's out of a job all of a sudden.
Yeah, well, so here's a real interesting part. You know how the economy, when it comes to holding items and using a barter economy, is very inflationary. Well, what happened was people realized that, well, maybe we want to store value between resets, or we want something that maintains a much more constant value, something that won't become, you know, inflationary, but rather would be deflationary, something that's static. So there was a site that came into being called D2JSP. And basically it was just a trading forum. It was like a stock market in a way, and you could buy forum gold is what they called it, which just whatever currency they you know fiated into being. You know, they just created their own currency, and it didn't really have any valuation other than it's just what the community decided to use.
That's well, also, I think it was a pretty major clan, and they originally had their clan forum, and it had a huge number of people in it who had just sort of, they all just agreed to start using it, and the clan was big enough that people expected the currency to still have value.
Yeah, so that's true. I guess it has a network effect going on.
Video games definitely have a lot more to do with economies than most people give them credit for. Like, definitely. These things are definitely relevant, right? Like, you can look at this from an economic standpoint, and it looks awesome, and it makes sense, and it's a good study.
Yeah, know? And one of the nice things is when you say that we can kind of validate our views, we're so on the fringe, we're talking about how, you know, people that appeal to authority just will say repeatedly, you guys are wrong, this is not how it works. But, you know, not only does it make sense to us, but we have all these validating examples right and left, and in, you know, the spontaneous order that arises in gaming communities and stuff like that. And you know, I love to see it too. I think there was a good Walter Block, I'm going to name drop again, you know, video on what money is, and I think it's, you know, it fits with what you guys are describing, if I understand right. He talks about, you know, it has to be scarce. You know, with Bitcoin, it's artificially scarce. We have code that one person wrote that excludes people. You know, with gold, there's only so much in the earth we can mine. And, you know,
crossing our fingers for them asteroids, right?
Yeah. And, you know, same thing in these communities. We have, it's scarce. I mean, you know, and in Eternal Summer, there's some intrinsic value to it, but you know, and also it's divisible, I think. Those are the two ones that are most, you know, memorable to me, is that it's something that's scarce and divisible, and people just start kind of inherently using it to trade and exchange, and people work their way out, and it's not always what we expect.
Yeah, kind of like how hats in TF2, Team Fortress 2, became sort of like gold, and then scrap metal kind of became like silver or like change, you know what I mean?
Yeah, like just like upside down stuff.
Like, people trade a hat plus a bunch of scrap metal for a better hat, or a weapon plus scrap metal for a hat, or whatever. Like, they use it just to pump up the value of the trade a little bit.
And yeah. If I can just inject my own subjective value there a little bit, I think my favorite hat from Team Fortress 2 is the giant upside-down boot, because it reminds me of Vermin Supreme so much.
Exactly. I love that one, too.
I haven't played that game nearly enough. I've never seen that.
It's fun. It sounds good, I mean, though. It's kind of interesting because the money is distributed on, like, a lottery basis, right? Like, you get them randomly, and everyone can only earn X amount per week. Like, it's maxed out, I think, at, like, 20 items or something a week that you can earn random.
Vermin Supreme. You just keep name-dropping, don't you?
By the way, if any listeners out there don't know who Vermin Supreme is, he is a person that runs for president every 4 years and always promises a pony for every man, woman, and child in America, as well as mandatory toothbrushing. He kind of...
In other words, a spoof political candidate or a satire one, but...
But he says it with such a straight face, and it's fantastic the parallels you can draw with the shit he says with standard politicians. And he wears a giant upside-down rubber boot on his head. He looks like a homeless man with a 2-foot beard, dresses like a homeless man, looks like he smells a little bit.
So good.
I mean, his name is Vermin Supreme. He probably does smell.
Yeah.
So, good topic. Thanks for introducing the video game economy. I actually wasn't aware of all the different ways people could trade in the Valve ecosystem.
Oh, it's definitely a good thing to take a look at. It's, from an outsider's perspective, it's really interesting.
It is fascinating, and in many ways, it's the one way we can have a kind of a controlled experiment. We can see economies that are organic in nature.
They're
real economies, but you can actually do experiments with them. You can control for the variables. There's a lot. It's not like the real economy where there's, you know, in an infinite number of variables, you can't keep track of everything. There's too many actors. You could kind of manage the data in these video games.
I actually remember hearing something about, I can't remember what economics department it was, but they were actually using EVE Online to study free markets. And I think maybe I had played that at the time or something, but I mean, it makes some sense.
And another thing that kind of goes along the same line, if anyone's ever heard of Second Life.
Oh, I've heard of it, certainly.
Yeah, it's like a virtual world that you can literally make any item you want if you know how to program and make a skin for it. You can do anything you want. You can, like, fly around like your magic. You can make cars, guns, kill people randomly, help people. It's kind of like a totally anarchic society online. But the way things work is you can buy property from the people who run the servers. And that kind of makes its own little economy based on that, how property value is kind of central to it all. Like, some property is extremely valuable. Like, there's a section full of furries. Like, furries are really big. And the property values in the furry land are considerably higher than the property values elsewhere.
I don't know why that is.
Because furries have expendable money, I guess. You know what I mean? Like, they don't have girlfriends to spend it on.
Yeah, I don't know.
Let's not go into that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I heard Pizzly Bear plays on that. He's in the furry section.
Pizzly Bear is a kind of a big digression. Is that as far as topics today? I know we're getting about 2 hours, and we've surmounted, at least I think we have a streaming issue, and things will continue to improve. How do you guys feel? A good place to try to wrap us down, remind people where we're coming from?
I think so. Why don't we go around, maybe give some shout outs, or if you've got anything final to say, we can do that.
Yeah, I wanted to so thank everybody for listening. You know, noting we're a bit all over the place, but we can only continue to improve. I want to remind people that, you know, for those of you that prefer more leisurely listening experience, you might want to check out our archived episodes, which should continue to accumulate this point forward. Again, you could probably find a link at declinefm.com. It's our new site. If you've got any topic suggestions, reddit.com, that's kind of how we all met, r/declinedestate. At reddit.com. And for future reference, again, the live stream. Again, sorry it wasn't working today. radio.rud-o.com/declinedestate.m3u, as in Mary 3 uniform. So, and if you, we're still working on distribution methods, so if you have any preferences on where you'd like to find us, don't hesitate to drop us a suggestion. And I guess the last thing I'd like to say, big thanks to all of our researchers and contributors. Declined Estate is a group effort. I think Eternal mentioned that, but you know, and remember, when asked, always Declined Estate.
All right, and this is Zom.
And this is Toasty Time, and I'm going to give myself one little shout out here that I had a fantastic idea earlier today, because I'm going into a master's of education program and to get licensed in my state. And what I plan to do is make a series of podcasts detailing my journey. You find out just exactly how bureaucratic things are. And yeah, I mean, I know it's licensed state. It was supposed to be apolitical, I know. But what I want to do is chronicle my experience there. And so you can stay on the lookout. I'll keep you informed on when this podcast, when the inception of it is. So, and we can move on.
That sounds interesting. Yeah. And this is Eternal. You know, it's great doing the first show. I think it went pretty well. Hope you guys really enjoyed it. Hope you all come out to the next one. Hopefully we'll have our streaming server working. We should have that up and running. Just, you can always at any time suggest content at www.reddit.com/declinedestate. Post up articles and links to other discussions either on Reddit or elsewhere that you want us to talk about. And, you know, we're always open to discussing anything you guys want.
Ron, except politics.
Want to take it out?
Yeah, let's take it out. Declined Estate is a group effort motivated by our love of liberty, as well as bow ties and monocles. And remember, when asked, always declined Estate.
All right, take care, everyone.
Ooh.